You're listening to CKUT. The following is a previously broadcast program. Stay tuned.
Hi, friends. I feel weird today. Hello, my guys, gals, and non-binary pals. This is Panacea every fourth and fifth Thursday of the month from 2 to 3 p.m. It's me, your host, Michelle. And this month, both this episode and next week's episode is dedicated to my friend Sean Samimi, who left his physical body and our earth too early. But his soul lives on, and his energy is a part of the airwaves that our shows thrive on. So we're going to cover loss and the non-linear experience of grief. And today we're just going to broadly cover a wide range of perspectives on death, grief, and loss, and also talk a little bit about depression if we have time for it and its close relationship to experiences of loss. And next week, we're sort of going to cover how these perspectives tell us on how to cope with loss and grief. So I'm pretty excited for that. Sean was a younger brother, a friend, and a son. He loved learning and he loved cooking. And something that he was passionate about was he lived his life with immense hope for the future. And he was really dedicated to supporting others and helping others while also going through his own healing journey and growing himself. And so he put a lot of time and effort and dedication into trying to improve the lives of others and finding ways that he can help other people. And so today we honor his life and we discuss some heavy emotions and thoughts that surround our experiences of grief and loss. And the fact that sometimes grief and loss also comes with a lot of additional barriers, like planning out the logistics for a funeral, which is something that's not always fun, but something that you have to do. But as always, let's begin with a song. This, no one judge me, this is Fire and Rain, but it's by the Glee cast. Do not laugh. I love the Glee cast, and I think this cover is really good. So, I'm going to play it. But, yeah. Okay.
Yesterday morning, they let me know you were gone. Suzanne, the plans they made put an end to you.
I walked out this morning and I wrote down this song. I just can't remember who to send it to. I've seen fire and I've seen rain. I've seen sunny days that I thought would never end. I've seen lonely times when I could not find a friend. But I always thought that I'd see you again. Won't you look down upon me, Jesus? You gotta help me make a stand. Just gotta see me through another day. My body's aching and my time is at hand. I won't make it any other way. Oh, I've seen fire and I've seen rain. I've seen sunny days that I thought would never end. I've seen lonely times when I could not find a friend. But I always thought that I'd see you again. Been walking my mind to an easy time. My back turned towards the sun.
Lord knows when the cold wind blows, it'll turn your head around. Well, there's hours of time on the telephone lines to talk about things to come. Sweet dreams and flying machines and pieces on the ground. Oh, I've seen fire and I've seen rain. I've seen sunny days that I thought would never end. I've seen lonely times when I could not find a friend. But I always thought that I'd see you, baby, one more time again now.
One more time.
Thought I'd see you one more time again. There's just a few things coming my way this time around now. But I always thought that I'd see you again.
PSA, I am not comfortable necessarily talking about grief and loss. It's very recent Anyways, yeah. And I'm also in no way an expert in how to manage these big emotions of grief and sadness and anger and confusion that surround the loss of a loved one. So I want this segment and next week's segment to be sort of a journey that we go on together in learning about life and learning about death and grief and loss, and also learning about ways to support our loved ones and ourselves. And so when I was writing this segment and next week's segment, I was like, okay, what should we begin with? Let's begin with fear. One of the four noble truths in Buddhism is sufferance or dukkha. And this states that everyone suffers in some form or another. And the second truth is the origin of suffering, or samudaya, which states that life is sufferance because of the impermanence of time, basically, right? We desire things and we suffer because we can't have them, or we desire things because we lose them. We suffer because we lose things or people that we desire, but we also suffer because we fear we may lose these things in the future. And the loss of life and the loss of a friend and the loss of a loved one and the loss of a family member is one of the greatest losses that humans can experience. And so humans have an innate fear of death. In psychology, this is called death anxiety, and a lot of suffering in the form of these negative affect or negative emotions like fear, anxiety, sadness, anger, and behaviors like avoidance or withdrawal or risk-taking behaviors or substance use can arise from a fear of loss, from this death anxiety. And so we oftentimes really don't like thinking about it. But the tricky thing is that we all die, right? Memento mori. But then, you know, sitting with this idea introduces a lot of uncomfortable questions like, what is the purpose of life? Why am I here? And what happens after death, right? These are all very uncomfortable ideas to sit with because we don't have a way to find an answer, and we don't think we'll ever get an answer unless we experience it ourselves. And even more, death can be premature, and death can happen before we feel it is just for someone's life to be concluded. And that adds like an additional layer of distress and a lot more questions like, why do we suffer then? Like, what is fair? Why is there pain? Who is causing this, right? Whose fault is this? And typically, we like to manage the anxiety that comes from the inevitability of death by embracing frameworks of meaning, right? Like cultural values and beliefs, or religious values and beliefs that give our lives meaning and purpose. And this is sort of what terror management theory argues is how humans cope with death anxiety, by embracing these frameworks of meaning. And so one really cool study, and there's been a bunch of studies on this, but one study looked at municipal court judges and their strictness of the bond that they set for bail. And so what this terror management theory tells us is that if humans are feeling death anxiety, if they're reminded of their mortality, right, they're going to embrace these frameworks of meaning to hold on to something that gives their lives meaning and purpose, and that relieves sort of some of that death anxiety. And so we should expect to see this when something like this happens. So in this experiment, these municipal court judges were asked to set a bond for a sex worker immediately after completing a questionnaire. And so half of these judges had a questionnaire that asked them questions relating to their thoughts and feelings on their own death. And then the other half of judges just like had a random questionnaire. And what the researchers found was that judges in the experimental group who had to do the questionnaire asking them questions about their own mortality actually set a significantly higher bond than those who just did the random questionnaire. So their bond was $455 versus $50. And so this is presumably because they were especially motivated to defend their belief systems in the face of a violation of the law, right? Because they were reminded about their own mortality. So they have this death anxiety, and that causes them to cling more tightly to their belief systems and try to uphold justice in the face of a violation of the law. And so these are those frameworks of meaning that we hold on to. Obviously, there are other frameworks. And so in many Western or individualistic or independent societies, there is a desire to defy death or outlast death, right? Death is something that's seen as is pretty negatively charged when we talk about it. Whereas in many collectivistic or interdependent cultures, death is also negatively charged, but it's accepted as a natural course of life, and it's not seen as a finite, definitive ending state, right? It's this distinction between we want to avoid death, we want to prolong life as much as we can, versus we can't avoid death, so let's accept it and find ways to work around our grief and live with our grief. And so one of these frameworks of meaning that we can adopt is Buddhism. And so just also remember that Buddhism has several different denominations across several cultures. And so not all conceptualizations of death, grief, loss, and the afterlife are the same for all Buddhists. But just very generally, one of the defining features of Buddhism is a belief in samsara, which is the cycle of life and death. And so Buddhists believe that every person experiences this sort of succession of death and rebirth and death and rebirth, because the ultimate goal is for an individual to be able to free themselves from all desires and the idea of an ego or self. And this comes from that idea of impermanence, right? You're attaching yourself, you're desiring things, and you suffer because you're attached to them and you cannot deal with the impermanence of time, the fact that things are lost over time and they're gained over time. And so once you're able to let go of all of these attachments and realize that individuality is an illusion and that we are all parts of a greater whole, an individual will reach what is like the ultimate state of enlightenment, which is known as nirvana. Obviously, when I say this, and to people who aren't familiar with the core values and beliefs of Buddhism, it sounds a little bit maybe cold, but that's not actually the intention. Buddhists teach us that, you know, to live with grief is to accept it and to live with it and to acknowledge that death is a natural part of life, but not to let that set us back in our experience of life or in our experiences of, in our experiences of life. And so they teach that, you know, accepting this and letting it go and letting it be and just not trying to attach yourself to these negative feelings or hold on to them or over-explain them and just accept the fact that we are grieving and this is a normal process and this is going to happen, but eventually we're going to learn how to live with it and it's going to get easier over time. Similarly, the Anishinaabe or Ojibwe perspective on life and death also follows a cyclical pattern, and this is called the circle of life. And so they believe that in order to understand death, one must first embrace the circle of life. And so birth, life, death, and afterlife are just four stages of the journey of the human spirit. And so the spirit in a human being will live forever, and it's always seen and felt leaving the body in the afterlife. And so these spirits are brought to existence by a creator. There is a creator I just had a brain fart. Anyways, there is a spirit that returns to the spirit world, this place of its origin, and it can leave and enter our physical bodies. And so what the death of the body, with the death of the body, allows entrance into the world of the spirit. And so, you know, these are based on levels. There's four levels of the spirit world where helpers of the creator work to teach us, heal us, guide us, and help us plan our ceremonial life. And so the first level in the spirit world, which is closest to earth, contains the creator spirit helpers who bring us dreams. And these dreams are helpful because they can teach us about certain things or warn us about things that might happen. The second level are spirit helpers who teach us and appear in ceremonies. And so they show, they come to us in visions, right? They show us these helpers and the messages that they carry. The third level of the spirit world is where spirit helpers are like mini corporate consultants, kind of, and they help us in planning healing ceremonies, and they also warn us of possible sources of trouble. In the fourth level of the spirit world, the spirit helpers are healers, and so they enter the body and bring messages about how to undergo healing and help us understand, you know, the medicines that we can derive from what the earth has to offer. And what's needed to help somebody. And so beliefs about the spirit world and the differing levels are similar in many traditional indigenous cultures. But let's talk about the Haudenosaunee or Iroquois perspectives on life and death, which state that there is a universal struggle between the upper world of benevolence and the lower world of disarray. And so humans during life have to negotiate and reconcile these two spheres of influence. And they have to do this in both life and death. And so upon death, there are also spirit forces at work that try to disrupt these journeys of the soul returning to the sky world, returning to its place of birth or place of creation. And so in this journey after life, the souls of the dead follow a path of destiny that they have to engage on before reaching the sky world. And so respect for the dead is shown at all times, and they believe that when certain rituals are performed, which is called the all-night dance or the dance of the dead, right? The spirits of all their ancestors from across the entire Turtle Island where they're located are believed to join in with them. And so they believe that, you know, there is no cultural, tribal, or language barriers that separate the dead from us and from the dead from the living. So we all like coexist together and our spirits live together. And so there are a lot of culturally based practices that surround this journey for the spirits to move from the death of the body towards the sky world. And the stars that we see in the sky are very much associated with the souls or the spirits that people leave behind that live on when people leave the physical earth. And so birth and death are connected. And each soul has its own destiny after death. So each soul in life has its destiny. And then after that destiny is completed, right, each soul then also has a different destiny in death. And so there is no really distinction between life and death, except for the fact that in one of them, we occupy a physical body, and in the other one, we don't necessarily occupy a physical body, but we still have the same journey. We still engage on some sort of journey. We have some sort of purpose to fulfill, and we're still coexisting with everyone together, which I think is very beautiful. Okay. That was a lot of talking. I feel like I'm talking a lot, and let's listen to some more music. This is Passport by Moondoggy. The vibes are about to change with the song, but this is a great song. Yeah.
Keep my passport in my pocket in case I need to catch a flight. You told me that, so I think it's alright. Had a dream about the last time that we took a little ride. Somewhere between the first and second line.
forget to turn out all the lights, but you take care of me when I have to leave. Dawn, I might sleep in past all my alarms, but you take care of us when I make it tough, because it takes all that I got not to fuck this up. So won't you let me know if I'm not alone, leaning on you. Was I fearless 17 years old, or was I thinking I was just a kid leaving home? Now I get scared for reasons I don't know. Is it just because I ain't tough enough to be alone? It takes all this up. So won't you let me know if I'm not alone? And I like what we got, but I'm scared of what it's not. So won't you let me know if I'm not alone, leaning on you.
So to recap, we just talked about a couple of perspectives on death. Something that I thought was really interesting when I was doing my research was that for Shiite Muslims, grief is actually a religious experience that's associated with a recognition of the tragic consequences of living justly in an unjust world. And so for them, the ability to experience grief fully is like a marker of the depth of personality that somebody has and understanding that somebody has. And so, like being able to feel all of your emotions and letting them be and experiencing and living through grief and sadness and pain, is something to be proud of. And it's something that's normative and it's something that should be accepted and I don't know, less stigmatized and talked about more often so that we can all support on each other and lean on each other. I'm not great at talking about this, so I'm doing my best. There's a lot less energy here for sure. Freud, our very dear friend Sigmund Freud, in 1927 wrote a book called The Future of an Illusion. And so Freud was anti-religious. He says, we are all afraid of dying, right? Yes, that's very true. We don't know what happens after. That's very true. And so we have anxiety about death. Very true. And so he says, believing in God, a comforting father figure, helps us cope with our uncertainties, right? This belief in God is a form, is a form of a defense mechanism against the anxieties and uncertainties of life. And so Freud says, fuck all that. Religion is a primary process. He says religion is a form of regression. These are Freud's thoughts, by the way, so bear with me. He says religion doesn't help us in the long run, right? It's just an illusion that we create for ourselves to provide some sort of temporary comfort. And so what he says is, well, we're adopting these frameworks of meaning and value to explain something that's ultimately inexplainable. And so because it doesn't help us in the long run, right, it doesn't actually provide us with finite evidence or proof that these things that we're holding on to are true, it's not helpful, and we're living in a state of disillusionment. And so this comfort that we receive from religion and from other frameworks of meaning are temporary, and they're not permanent. But he doesn't really tell us how we can find some sort of permanent comfort. And, you know, even when we think about a lot of ways that, you know, humans over the centuries have tried to explain why is there suffering, right? We've tried to answer this question of why is there suffering, and there just doesn't seem to be an answer that satisfies us. And so what can we do to ease the distress that comes with suffering? Well, a lot of people try to explain it away in stories. They try to, for example, Greek tragedy or like Oedipus Rex, for example, right, was a play about suffering, but there's nothing we can do to explain it that says that we can't escape our fate, right? It's our destiny. It's Moira. And the more that Oedipus Rex tries to run away from his fate, the more that he actually ends up fulfilling it. And so we can just sort of hope to represent suffering in, I don't know, forms of these, you know, tragic plays, in hopes that it offers some sort of catharsis for human beings to identify aspects of themselves in the play. I mean, hopefully not all of us want to have sex with our mother and kill our father. But, you know, identifying parts of suffering that appear in the play and using that as some sort of cathartic release. And this sort of ties back to the conversation that I had with Saoirse a few months ago, where we talked about creativity and the importance of creativity in expressing and working through our emotions, sometimes in even in unintentional ways. And so, yeah, on to another philosopher, Plato. Our dear friend Plato, he has the Platonic doctrine of recollection, or anamnesis, which he says that humans can obtain knowledge of these pure forms, like these abstract concepts of goodness, of beauty, of equality, etc., by focusing on the innate knowledge brought by the immortal soul. So he says that knowing is remembering. And so there's no real learning that we uncover throughout life. We're just actually learning the things that we've already talked about. I mean, we're relearning the things that this immortal soul that our soul used to be a part of has already talked about. And so he says that our souls are immortal, and they're made of leftovers of this cosmic, all-knowing soul. And so, at birth, our human souls are taken from this all-knowing universal cosmic soul, and they're injected into our bodies. And that, Plato says, is a very violent process. And so our souls become damaged, and we forget what the all-knowing cosmic soul once knew. But it's still within us, right? This knowledge is still within us. The soul is still within us. So using reason, we can uncover what we forgot. And so basically, Plato also echoes a lot of these religious frameworks of meaning in talking about the fact that our souls are immortal. And so to summarize many of these perspectives, right, many of them conceptualize death not as a final stop, but as a transformation or a transition from one state to another. And while we often juxtapose science and religion with each other, actually, interestingly enough, perspectives from science, specifically from physics, also conceptualize death in a similar way. And so this is something that I've been thinking about a lot in the last few weeks, when I'm just been thinking about grief and working through grief. I found a lot of comfort from physics. I don't know, this probably isn't the same for everybody, but today I just want to take a focus more, less on like logically rationalizing our feelings and emotions and sort of just explaining them and finding ways to find comfort and solace, instead of just, you know, trying to rationalize them, which we will get to next week, just not today. So let's begin with some simple ideas about physics. I'm so excited to talk about this. The fundamental laws of physics, and like the laws of conservation of mass and energy, state that all the matter or energy in the universe is already here. It cannot be created or destroyed. So Einstein, in his theory of special relativity, introduced an equation to us that we all might know, which is E equals mc squared. And from that, we learn that matter can be converted into energy and vice versa. And so we also know that energy can be transformed into many different forms of energy, right? There's kinetic energy, potential energy, electrical energy, thermal, gravitational, nuclear energy, etc. So in this sense, there's simply just a series of changes or transformations of matter into energy, energy into matter, or energy into other forms of energy, right? There is no loss of anything. There is one set finite volume, and the things within that set volume just change. I hope that makes sense. And so another very consoling conservation law involves information, right? According to the law of the conservation of information, everything that happens or that will happen will leave a mark permanently on the universe. And so eons after you die, after the earth and the sun have vanished and there's nothing left, but space and particles, every minute detail of your life will endure in some form, supposedly. And I'll sort of try and come back and touch on this, but in a sense, in this way, right, we as human beings hold a place in time much longer and greater than we do in space, right? We endure in time. And if you look, it's way too difficult and hard, and I'm not well-versed enough in it to explain it, but in some theories of quantum physics and of the universe, they say that there's units of time, and there's only like a series of infinite nows, and each now that we are a part of, right, each present time and moment that we are a part of is permanent. It's part of the units of time. It has passed, and it will always be there, and it always has been there. So that's really comforting. And in fact, in 1955, when Albert Einstein's lifelong friend Michel Basso died, he wrote, "Now he has departed from this strange world a little ahead of me. That means nothing. People like us who believe in physics know that the distinction between past, present, and future is only a stubbornly persistent illusion." And so time, from a physicist's perspective, is a very interesting and mysterious phenomenon. And many physicists like Carlo Rovelli and Brian Greene have all talked about and struggled with uncovering the quote-unquote true nature of time. And what we find is that time is simply a measure of change. It's a measure of change, and nothing else, right? There's not a lot when we look at the fundamental nature of time. And so let's try and break that down. But maybe we should start with a song? Yes. I think we should start with a song. This is Motel 6 by River Wireless.
Long time lover, have you gone? I left you walking through the parking lot of a Motel 6. As I turned, I ran back east. Somewhere on the road, we lost our way. In my mind, I can save us all. I can breathe it all back to life. In my mind, and in my mind, I spend my whole life moving. I spend my whole life on a road. From a dream I'm waking up, and for the first. Terrified of waking up alone.
to a life that I deemed worth living all my life. And in my hands, a child is dying. In my mind, I can save the boy. I can bring it all back to life. In my mind, I've spent
guys, I'm really excited to talk about physics. Like, I've been waiting for this. Okay. We don't have a lot of time, though. So, when we look at the fundamental equations in physics, there's no mathematical distinction between forward in time and backwards in time. What does that mean? So, if we replace t in the equations with negative t, which stands for time, the equations still work. And so, what does that mean, right? If the fundamental equations make no distinction between past and future, right? Forward in time, backward in time, t and negative t. Why are the past and future so different from the perspective of our experience, right? So for example, if I take a video and I showed you a video on my phone of a single particle moving, you know, vibrating around, buzzing around on the screen, whatever, and show it to you, and I'm like, tell me if this video is going forward or if I'm showing you this video in reverse, right? It would be really hard for you to say that. But, right, if we're looking at a video of 100 gazillion trillion billion particles into the mix, right? When we're looking at a video, for example, of humans walking, right? That's hundreds of millions and trillions of particles. If I show you a video of someone, you know, of a ball being thrown into the air by me, and I'm throwing it, I don't know, into a distance so far because I have such a strong arm, You would be a lot more confident in telling me if the video was forward or if it was in reverse. And so our macroscopic experience of time makes a distinction between the past and the future. But in principle, in the fundamental equations of physics, there is no distinction between past and future. And so why does that make sense? Well, when we follow the relative arrow of time from what we call the past into what we call the future, we discover that entropy increases with time. And entropy in this case is disorder. And so it's a way to describe the change of energy and matter into other forms of energy and matter. So for example, if I suddenly start shuffling around on the ground with my feet, I'm going to be creating a lot of entropy, right? Because I'm introducing change into the system where my feet rubbing on the ground, on the floor, will create friction with the particles on the floor, particles, and that'll generate some sort of heat energy. And it'll cause the particles to vibrate at a higher frequency, right? These are all very minuscule things, and they're very hard to distinguish, but they're there, and that's change, and that's disorder. And so every time that something changes, right, we're introducing more and more disorder into the universe. And it makes more sense. It's more likely for an egg to crack open than it is for it to uncrack, or a glass of water to spill over than it is to unspill over, right? We're always moving more and more into disorder. And so time, however, when we're thinking about time, right, then it's not really part of the temporal structure of the universe. And so I'm going to use the works of St. Augustine, of Proust, and Carlo Rovelli in Psychological Concepts to talk about how time and the nature of time is connected to our experience of loss, grief, and suffering. And so St. Augustine was a philosopher who wrote about the nature of time in his book Confessions. And he says that when we listen to music, we get meaning from a musical phrase, from a melody, from a verse, right? But we never listen to the phrase. We only listen to one note at a time or one chord at a time. But if we listen to only one note at a time, how do I know about the previous notes, right? How do I know that the one note that I'm hearing now belonged with the previous one, and that previous one belonged with the previous one, and they all belong together to form a sequence of notes called a memory, called a phrase, right? Called a verse, called a melody. Well, of course we know that, right? Because we can remember them. We have a memory of the previous notes in our head. So we can form an impression of the phrase, of the melody, and derive meaning from there. And so the meaning from this musical phrase, our enjoyment that comes from it, our pleasure that comes from it, really comes from the note being played now and the memory of the previous ones. So we combine all of them together in the present. We combine all of these moments together in the quote-unquote present because we have memory. Right? And so the brain then is designed by evolution to use our memory to anticipate a purpose, to get somewhere or to do something, right? We want to use our past memories to help us predict the future, so that we can, you know, get ahead in life, and so that we can avoid danger, and so that we can get along with people. And so Carlo Rovelli sort of tells us that then this passage of time is not something irrational to contemplate, right? It's very emotionally charged. Time is something that we live into. We are a passage of time, right? We can think about a reality without space, without things. But it's very hard to think of yourself in a reality without time, because time we use is something that we use to measure change, and it's something that we use to predict change. But it's not because reality cannot be thought of without time. It's because we as humans cannot think without time. And this is a hypothesis, not been properly proven, but it's one of the prevailing theories. And so the universe is just a bunch of things or events in which, in some approximations, are very nicely ordered, right? In some approximations, the egg is more likely to crack than it is to uncrack. The glass is more likely to tip over than it is to untip over, right? And they seem very nicely ordered to us. But when we think about time, it's just our human evolution and the way that our brain is designed to create memories from the past and combine them with the future to help us anticipate, and combine them with the present to help us anticipate the future. So, terror management theory in psychology is something that's used to explain the concept of death anxiety. This theory tells us that humans and animals have an instinctive drive for self-preservation. And because we have evolved these complex cognitive functions, we are self-aware and we want to anticipate future outcomes, right? That's what I just talked about. But this makes it so that we are aware of the inevitability of death and that it can occur at any time. And it also makes us attach a lot of emotional valence and emotional value to things that have happened in the past and things that will happen in the future, because we have desires and we don't want to lose things. And so this friction between a desire for self-preservation and the awareness that death is inevitable and unpredictable creates feelings of anxiety and terror whenever you are reminded of your own mortality. And so a lot of behavior that we engage in is motivated to deal with this potential death anxiety. And so in this way, right, time is, again, emotionally colored for us. It is not emotionally neutral, because we are full of motivation. We are full of hunger and love and ambition and empathy before we want to be rational beings, right? It's very hard for us to separate our emotions from our logic and our decisions, because our brain is a machine designed to tell us a story about the past and to do something in the future. And so, right, the truth of Buddhism's life is sufferance. Life is sufferance because we have difficulty dealing with the impermanence. We have difficulty dealing with time. And so time is a source, can be a source of our suffering, right? Time is our emotional connection to the events of the world that go away, that pass, that flow, and that we lose. But we shouldn't allow this to stop us from feeling those emotions, or we shouldn't take this as a fact to reject our emotions, but rather something that tells us that change is a constant and that things pass and that they flow, but things will pass and these hard emotions will pass. They might not pass right away and they might not pass all the time and they might come back, and that's okay. But I don't know where I'm trying to go with this. My brain is very uncomfortable talking about this and trying to work through it at the same time that I'm teaching other people this. Anyways, a strong emotional connection with time and the emotion of time, Carlo Rovelli says, is what time is for us. And so we should be very proud that humans have emotions and that we attach a lot of value to things that we lose, because that's the fundamental nature of humans, right? That's the fundamental way that we view the world. It's our emotional connection to the world. And so time for us is not a single thing. It's all of these things that come from the relation of the world to our function of the brain. And so I sort of want to end today with a quote from Aaron Friedman, who talked about why you want a physicist to speak for you when you die. My teacher in grade 10 world religions class read this to our class, and I have thought about this since then, and I really did not think I would be able to find this quote because I don't have my old school email, and I don't even remember what exactly they said. But I found the quote, which is so exciting. I love like finding things that I didn't think that I would be able to find. And I found it. So this is the quote. You want a physicist to speak at your funeral. You want the physicist to tell your grieving family about the conservation of energy, so they will understand that your energy has not died. You want the physicist to remind your sobbing mother about the first law of thermodynamics, that no energy gets created in the universe and none is destroyed. You want your mother to know that all of your energy, every vibration, every BTU of heat, every wave of every particle that was her beloved child remains with her in this world. You want the physicist to tell your weeping father that amid the energies of the cosmos, you gave as good as you got. And at one point, you'd hope the physicist would step down from the pulpit and walk to your broken-hearted spouse there in the pew and tell them that all the photons that ever bounced off your face, all the particles whose paths were interrupted by your smile, by the touch of your hair, all of these hundreds of trillions of particles have raced off like children, their ways and their paths and their trajectories forever changed by you. And as your widow rocks in the arms of a loving family, may the physicists let them know that all the photons that bounced off you were gathered in the particle detectors that are their eyes, and that those photons created within them constellations of electromagnetically charged neurons whose energy will go on forever. You can hope that your family will examine the evidence and satisfy themselves that the science is sound, and that they'll be comforted to know that your energy is still around. According to the law of the conservation of energy, not a bit of you is gone. You're just less orderly. Aaron Friedman. Thank you for listening to Panacea this week. I will see you next week for a discussion on what is grief? What is the grief process? Are grief and loss synonymous with depression? How can we separate the experiences of quote-unquote normal depressions and perhaps more maladaptive depressions from the experience of grief? And we're going to talk about how some of these different perspectives, these different frameworks of meaning, what they have to say about grief and what they have to say about honoring each other's lives. And we'll also talk about how to support our friends and our family and our loved ones and ourselves when working through this non-linear process of grief, because it's hard, and we should lean on our people. Thanks for tuning in. This is CKUG 90.3 FM. See you guys next week at 2 p.m. Stay forever. We're going to end today with one of Sean's favorite songs. This is Drop the Game. Your soul. And then Reggie Moore's going to take over and tell me some things that you've done. Bye.
I've been feeling old. I've been feeling cold. You're the heat that I know. Listen, you are my son. I said there's more to life than rush. Not gonna leave this place with us. Drop the game, it's not enough. Hush. I said there's more to life than rush. Not gonna leave this place with us. Drop the game, it's not enough.
Is there from 3 to 5, CKUT 90.3 FM, the number one radio station. Yabunu said so, Roger Moore.
Straight. Nah, mix the herbs with the white powder. Nah, go mix the herbs with the pink powder. Rasta herbs are for clean. Rasta herbs are for vital. Herbs strong. Me never use no 14, 28, 14. Look how me herbs them clean.
Run it, 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 run it.